in this neighborhood and all neighborhoods of the city to be safe. And I want criminals to know that we're looking for you.
Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn says he currently has enough staff to watch all the monitors, but eventually may have to assign more officers who are unable to be on street patrol. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Governor Walker is releasing his first television ad in the governor's race, pushing back against Democratic challenger Mary Burke's message that unemployment has gone up under his watch. The Republican incumbent launched his first ad on the same day that Burke was running her initial spot. Unemployment was 7.8% when Walker took office. It is 6.3% now. In the weather forecast for tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain and snow in southern Wisconsin, otherwise lows in the single digits. Tomorrow, mostly clear with highs in the mid to upper 20s. And on Sunday, partly cloudy with highs in the mid 30s to around 40. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Noah Ovshinsky.
Support for WPR comes from our contributing members. Your investment brings insightful news and thought-provoking programs to your radio every day. Thank you for making WPR a powerful resource in Wisconsin and beyond.
Wisconsin Public Radio is everywhere. On the radio, online, on demand, on your smartphone, on the way to work, on your mind. Go to WPR.org and turn it on.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, campaign ads and the race for governor on the air. Both major party candidates went to the airwaves, and we'll find out what they're saying and why they're saying it 8 months ahead of Election Day.
First, just over a year ago, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel started an investigation of the law enforcement activities of the ATF, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Reporters found evidence of mistakes and questionable tactics in a sting operation, from a military-style machine gun lost on the streets to a brain-damaged man pressured into buying guns and then charged with a felony.
The story is ongoing, with ATF officials testifying last month before a congressional committee led by Wisconsin Representative Jim Sensenbrenner. To bring us up to date, we have John Diedrich, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been working on the Backfire series over the last year. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What first tipped you off about the ATF's activities in Milwaukee?
Well, in late 2012, I received a tip that ATF agent's guns had been stolen. You alluded to this at the beginning. They were stolen from his vehicle that was parked outside a coffee shop here in Milwaukee. I checked in with the ATF. They asked us to hold off on disclosing that information, which we did for a couple months, checking in with them periodically. And then we heard from a landlord who described how he had unwittingly rented to the ATF for this for a storefront operation, and how they had damaged his property and refused to pay for it, along with high utility bills and other costs.
So this storefront sting operation was what looked like a business called Fearless Distributing. What was the ATF doing having this fake business in Milwaukee?
Well, as we came to find out, this is a tactic that's been used, a technique across the country by the ATF. The idea is that you set up phony businesses. In this case, it was a store that sold clothing, drug paraphernalia, things of that nature. But it's all wired up, so they're videotaping everything. The people behind the counter are undercover ATF agents, and their real aim is to get individuals to bring them guns, illegal guns, crime guns, and also narcotics. And so they set up in the River West neighborhood in Milwaukee, which is on the near east east side, just over the river, in a fairly quiet neighborhood, not a high crime area. And their cover story was that they were a gang from New York, and that they were buying these guns and shipping them back east.
So what was the goal of this nationwide operation? Who were they hoping that they would sweep up here and arrest?
Well, so this has been going on at least going back to 2005, 2004. We found operations as far back, and we're told that these have gone on perhaps even before that. The idea, according to ATF, is to target violent individuals who would traffic in guns and narcotics and take them off the street. What we found in our reporting, other than a lot of the missteps that we found that you alluded to, is that this technique tended to attract individuals who were not high up the sort of food chain, if you will, of criminal activity. So they, for instance, would bring in people who did have felonies in their background and cannot possess guns, but might just be bringing in guns to make a few dollars. Or, as we found, they were paying such high prices that individuals were able to get other individuals to buy guns from stores such as Gander Mountain and turn around and make a very tidy profit with money that the ATF would pay.
Along the way, you focused on the story of Chauncey Wright, one of the people caught up in this. And I'd like, if you would, to tell his story, how he got into this and what happened to him.
Sure. So at the beginning of the operation, one of the things that the agents were trying to do was to get the word out that they were open for business and that they were interested to have people come to the store. One of the ways they were doing this was handing out flyers at a Walmart that's near the store in River West area in Milwaukee. At that store, they ran into Chauncey Wright. Chauncey Wright is a young man in his mid-20s. He has a very low IQ, an IQ that is measured in to be 54. The way Chauncey ended up being in the situation that he is he nearly died as an infant. He slipped under the water in a bathtub, was unattended for a period of time, and so his brain was without oxygen. Reads at a six-year-old level. He didn't go into high school. He's had a hard time keeping a job and so forth. He does have a felony on his record prior to meeting them, and that was for selling small amounts of cocaine on the street. And so what happens is he goes to these individuals and says, hey, can I get a job with you? And they said, sure, that'd be great. And so he starts handing out flyers, and then he starts working at the store. All the while, people close to Chauncey, including his grandmother, his girlfriend, his brother, and others, are saying, there's something not right about this store. It's really on a dead-end street. It's not the kind of place that you would think of. And what Chauncey kept saying to them is, he said, you know, these are my guys. They're looking out for me. And what they're doing in the meantime is they're paying Chauncey to work at the store in cigarettes and merchandise from the store and also cash. And what happens after a little while is they start telling Chauncey, hey, can you get us guns? We want to get guns and drugs and so forth. And so that's what he starts to do. And he starts acting as a middleman for a number of these transactions. And then in the end, he ends up getting arrested, of course, with everyone else. He has no idea what this is, and he ends up going into the federal court system. When they learn about his IQ, he ends up having a modified plea agreement, but he is convicted, and he ended up with a sentence of probation.
And this isn't the only case. You looked at other operations around the country. This isn't the only case where agents locally latched onto somebody with a low IQ, somebody in Chauncey's situation, pressured them to buy guns, and then arrested them for it.
That's right. And just a little bit of background, how we ended up taking the investigation outside of Milwaukee is we found out all these problems, the stolen gun, including the machine gun, which remains unrecovered, Chauncey Wright's story, and there's a myriad of other problems that happened in Milwaukee. After our investigation came forth, congressional members started asking questions, and ATF assured congressional members that this was an isolated situation and that it was really a problem in Milwaukee that they were going to address. So our investigation looked out to other cities to say, is this true? And we found individuals in other cities, in four other cities, where individuals that had a low IQ were used by the operation to promote the operation in a way. For instance, there was a man in in Portland, Oregon, he came in and he has a low IQ, and he was convinced, along with another man, by the ATF to get a tattoo on their neck with the logo of the fake storefront, which is a large squid smoking a joint on their neck. It took 3 hours to get the tattoo on. It runs from his ear down to his shoulder, paid for with tax dollars. There was a man in Wichita, Kansas, very similar to Chauncey, who was hired to work at the store. He was paid in cigarettes. He was, like Chauncey, riding his bike around, promoting the store, handing out flyers and so forth. His grandmother, very similar, said, this is Tony Brunner, says, this is not something you should be involved with, Tony. And same thing, he ends up getting charged in the end. And there's a similar story from Pensacola, Florida, and from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
As this story emerged and as the bad apple idea maybe was tossed away as these other cases around the country came up, what the ATF, what have prosecutors said as far as success? Can they point toward any upside of these operations?
Yes, and you know, we pointed out in our investigation that there were individuals in the Milwaukee operation, for instance, and in these other operations as well, who got substantial sentences. What we didn't see in the Milwaukee operation was evidence that somebody like a gang leader or a large criminal enterprise was taken down. It was individuals who had continued to engage in criminal activity, and under the federal court system, that's going to get you some time, a substantial amount of time in prison. But the ATF, in congressional testimony last week and so forth, they've said they've clearly acknowledged that they've got some serious shortcomings in these operations, and that they've issued a manual. They didn't have a manual before on how to run these, and they have a whole bunch of stringent rules that they say will help alleviate this or prevent this from happening. But they do point to the fact that, you know, we had so many individuals arrested and so many guns seized and so forth. But what we don't really know looking at those numbers, and at first, they seem very impressive, and that's what they have at the end of these operations is often a press conference laying out the guns and so forth, is you don't know where those guns came from. For instance, how many of those guns came from a store, as they did in Milwaukee, a number of the guns, not all of them, but a number of the guns came directly from stores, and how many of the individuals, were involved in operations that were maybe not or offenses that were not that serious. For instance, in Portland, Oregon, they situated the store directly across the street from a middle school. Well, what that allowed them to do was, and they said later that that was a mistake, but the fact remained that that allowed the prosecutor to charge all the individuals in state court and also to seek enhancements in federal court for being within 1,000 feet of a school. You know, that's a safe zone, and federal law is supposed to keep guns away. The ATF has said that was a mistake, along with a number of other things. But they're standing by the technique, but they're acknowledging that there are a lot of mistakes and shortcomings.
We're talking to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter John Diedrich about his Backfire series on ATF sting operations in Milwaukee and elsewhere in the nation.
You can join the conversation with your questions and your reactions to his series and what he's talking about here today. Are you hoping to see more oversight of the ATF? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the story after this look at some of the latest news with Noah Ovshinsky.
Conservatives who are gathered for a conference near Washington have heard from another possible presidential candidate, Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who told them that President Barack Obama is running roughshod over Americans' civil liberties. Earlier today, former Senator Rick Santorum told the gathering that Republicans lose elections when they nominate moderate candidates. Stocks have finished mixed at the end of an indecisive day of trading. Investors are still worried about escalating tension in Ukraine, and that dampened some of the optimism created by this morning's jobs report. The government said far more jobs were created in February than in either of the two preceding months. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and the Conservation Congress have formed a new fishing advocacy group. The Wisconsin Fisheries Advisory Council will advise the DNR's Fisheries Management Board and the Congress on statewide issues ranging from long-term fisheries plan to balancing anglers' competing interests. The first council meeting is set for March 29th near Stevens Point. For Central Time, I'm Noah Ovshinsky.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers.
If you're still driving a big SUV, you know that filling up that gas tank can be painful.
Yeah, your tank's only half full, and you've exceeded the limit on your credit card.
Well, we can help. Donate your old gas hog through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program.
Your donation will help this station pay for your favorite programs, and you'll get a tax deduction.
And here's how it works. Call 1-866-789-8627 or go to WPR.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Take Wisconsin Public Radio on the go wherever you go. Listen to our live broadcasts, our archived programs, and the latest from WPR News. Go to WPR.org/mobile app to download.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with John Dietrich of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're talking about Backfire, his investigative series on the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and the sting operations it ran in Milwaukee and elsewhere.
You can join with your questions and your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. To your calls in just a minute, John, but first I want to get into some of the mistakes you found. First, you mentioned the lost machine gun. Can you talk about what happened?
Yeah, what happened in that case was the ATF agent, the chief undercover agent, left his car with these guns in the back. We're told that they were in a lockbox in the back of the truck. They were two handguns, government-issued handguns, and then fully automatic weapon. And the reason for that is this individual is on an entry team, so that's why he would have such a weapon. Those three weapons were stolen, the ATF actually bought back one of its own weapons the day after this at the storefront. But those other two guns, despite much searching, remain at large. And it's great concern, because that kind of weapon, the machine gun, poses a great risk to law enforcement. The other missteps in Milwaukee include the operation itself was burglarized, and the thieves made off with nearly $40,000 worth of merchandise. That was because the ATF had neglected to have a burglar alarm on the store. They left behind sensitive law enforcement documents. These documents included the names of undercover agents, their actual names, their cell phone numbers, their vehicle types, the takedown signs that law enforcement uses, so something that they wouldn't want certainly out in the public. They also arrested four of the wrong people during the roundup, including one man who was already in prison on an ATF charge. At the time, those cases were quickly disposed of. And there was an individual who, a felon, who was allowed to leave the store. He was with a gun. And this was an individual who was threatening to shoot somebody, to do harm to somebody, because his cousin had been shot. And they didn't have takedown cars outside for this sort of thing. And that was another shortcoming that the ATF has identified as to, what needs to change in the future, is that they didn't have, some sort of basic planning and safety measures in place.
We'll go to our callers now. We have James on the line in Milwaukee. James, hi.
Hi there. I just had a couple of quick questions. I was just wondering if there's any way for legislation to be able to control this and rein this in, or if there's any pending legislation. I'm not sure what kind of control could be put on it. The other thing I was wondering was, what was the cost of the Milwaukee operation? And, just wondering relative to the amount of heinous criminals that were apprehended.
Great. Thanks for the call. John, let's take that last one first. Do we have a notion of what this cost?
We do not. And that was something that we and members of Congress have been asking for more than a year, for an itemization of what the costs were, not just the amount that was paid for the weapons, but also the agent's time, the rent. Agents came from out of town, so there was per diem costs and housing costs and things of that nature. That's one of the questions that members of Congress had, not only about the Milwaukee operation, was elsewhere. And the question is, was it worth it? You know, what was the dollar amount that was spent, and was it worth it for, you know, for what the cases were that were generated? To the first question on legislation, members of Congress from both parties, this is one of those issues that has really touched a nerve in both parties. Want answers on this. And, you know, the question of whether it's legislation or just oversight, what is really troubling to these members of Congress, Tammy Baldwin and James Sensenbrenner, for instance, are both asking questions, Wisconsin Democrat and Republican, are, you know, how is this happening in light of the fact that the ATF has just gone through this major scandal known as Fast and Furious, where guns walked into, that's the term of art, but walked into Mexico while agents were observing that. And there were supposed to be a whole bunch of reforms in place to prevent this. Yet, you know, here we have this operation coming right after that in Milwaukee and other places. And that's partially what the Inspector General from the Department of Justice is looking at. And so what we're hearing right now is there has been a congressional hearing. There's going to be another one. The Inspector General who works for the Department of Justice is looking into it. And what I'm hearing from members of Congress is they want to hear not only what that investigation finds, but what the hearing, the next hearing, will prove and will bring forward in terms of answers from ATF.
Back to the phones now. We have Peg with us in West Milwaukee. Peg, hi.
Hi. I would like to ask what kind of disciplinary action was taken against the agents involved and their supervisors. Hmm. And I'm going to hang up and listen.
Peg, thanks. John, consequences for agents involved or people involved in planning these operations?
Another great question. This is something that we've been asking about, and members of Congress, it sounds like a broken record, but for more than a year we've been asking this. Okay, so here's what we know is the agent that was in charge of the operation has been transferred to Washington. They will not characterize that as whether that was a punitive move or if that was maybe a promotion. We don't know. The undercover agent whose guns were lost, he has since been transferred elsewhere. The one thing that we had heard was a punitive move, and this was told to members of Congress, is that there's an individual who was working out of the St. Paul office, and St. Paul has jurisdiction over Milwaukee. That individual was promoted shortly after this operation, and then he was demoted. And so initially it looked like, okay, well, here's the punishment coming down. It's a gentleman by the name of B.J. Zaper. But what happened in his case is he was promoted, but then when he was demoted, he was put in charge of the Phoenix office, of all places. That's where Fast and Furious took place. And it appears to be a move of convenience, because if he is going to retire and he's close to that age, that's an area that he's lived before, perhaps has property and relations there and so forth. And so it doesn't look like much of a punishment at this point. But that's an open-ended question. And frankly, that's one of the questions that ATF top officials did not answer when they were on the Hill. And I know that members of Congress want that. When Todd Jones, who is the director now, and he's the full confirmed director, the agency hadn't had one for a long time, now they do. That, I know, will be a question that will be asked of him when he comes up to the Hill.
John, something just occurred to me. Did the ATF coordinate with local law enforcement in these operations, or at least let them know they were there and what they were doing?
They did. There were two Milwaukee police officers who were embedded, if you will, in the operation. And there were questions, and this is one of the reforms that they've had, is that they need to make sure that they coordinate well with all their local partners. But the latest reform that they mentioned last week, I should say that they also said they have these stringent rules, yet they haven't. None of these operations are actually happening now nationwide. So they've in effect shut them down nationwide for the time being. But one of the rules that they're going to have now is that they need to have a local law enforcement partner, say the Milwaukee Police Department or a sheriff's office somewhere or whatever, to ask them, to invite them to come in and do this kind of operation. But, you know, that was one of the questions, talking to my sources. I've covered law enforcement here for a decade, is, you know, there was a lot of suspicious things going on. You know, was there enough notice given to other law enforcement to make sure there wasn't a problem? And that's especially true when you have individuals who are talking about felons who are talking about doing harm to somebody being allowed to leave with a gun. Now, I should say we don't know if that individual did shoot somebody. That's not in any report, but we do know that gun has not been recovered in Milwaukee.
John, we'll leave it there, but I'm hoping we can have you back on as the story develops further. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'll be happy to come back.
That was Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter John Diedrich talking about his investigative reporting on ATF sting operations in Milwaukee.
Coming up, campaign ad season is here as both major candidates hit the airwaves with commercials. We'll hear what they're saying and whether it will be effective. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. Good evening. I'm Noah Ovshinsky. Several Republican-led election bills are moving through the legislature as it moves into the final 2 weeks before the end of the session. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that 8 of the 15 election-related bills have Democratic support, but a spokesman for Republican Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says the fate of 4 other elections-related bills is unknown. One proposal would limit in-person absentee voting to between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. This week, we'll try to bring some glamour back to the humble root vegetables.
But first, Wisconsin's Democratic candidate for governor, Mary Burke, unveiled the first ad of her campaign. Let's take a listen.
Mary Burke. Today, 930 people work at Trek, the great Wisconsin company she helped build. And when she was Commerce Secretary, there were 72,000 more jobs than today. So why Scott Walker's RGA spending $1 million attacking her? Under Walker, unemployment's up, job prospects are down to 45th in the nation, and the layoffs continue. There's a better way. A strong economy starts with a strong middle class, and that's what Mary Burke's working on every day.
Governor Walker was quick to respond with a counter ad, which he called a fact check of Mary Burke's ad.
Let's fact check Mary Burke's very first TV ad. Burke says, under Walker, unemployment's up.
Quite the contrary, Mary. When Governor Walker took office, the unemployment rate was 7.8%. Today it's 6.3, the lowest it's been since 2008. Over 100,000 more jobs. So why would you start your campaign out with a lie? The facts? Unemployment's going down under Walker. And we can't trust Mary Burke.
Barry Burden joins us now to break down the ads and whether they make a difference. He's professor of political science at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So it looks like we've got the opening salvo in the battle for the airwaves with the first Mary Burke ad and then the Scott Walker rebuttal. What do you make of this quick 1-2 punch from the Democratic candidate and Governor Walker?
You know, we just wait for that first ad to be aired by either side, and then the other a campaign feels obligated to respond, and suddenly we're in an arms race. So I think we're off to the races. It's only March, but we should expect these kinds of ads, this back and forth, to continue from now till November.
Is it typically that quick a turnaround? You see an ad and a response, you know, just the same day the original ad comes out?
Well, the Walker campaign was clearly prepared for this. They had done their opposition research on Mary Burke's background, had that ad or some version of it, the pieces of it ready to go, and could respond quickly. So Burke should be on the lookout. If she's willing to offer fire, she's going to get it in return pretty quickly.
Now, this was her first campaign ad, but she had been apparently responding to ads that the Republican Governors Association had been airing against her so far that have been airing already. What kind of difference did those ads make?
Well, you know, Burke is mostly unknown to the electorate at this point. The most recent Marquette poll showed that something like 70% of the people it interviewed didn't have a strong enough opinion about her one way or the other to say whether they viewed her favorably or unfavorably. So she really needs to get into the business of introducing herself to the electorate. She has some time to do that, but it has to happen in relatively short order. And an introductory ad like the one she aired is a way to do that. And I think the fear is that if the Walker campaign gets off the marks first, it can define her before she has an opportunity to do it.
Now, both the ads that we heard there, they focus on jobs and the economy, obviously, from very different perspectives. But will these be the predominant issues in the race?
I think they will. It's going to be about dueling statistics. That's what our campaigns have come down to. Which set of numbers would you like to present? Which set do you believe? They do point in different directions depending on the comparisons you make and what indicator you want to look at.
Well, let's talk about a little bit the numbers that are presented in those ads. Mary Burke saying that unemployment is up under Governor Walker. Governor Walker saying not so fast and characterizing Mary Burke as someone who can't be trusted. Can you give us a sense of where these dueling numbers come from?
Yeah, the specific comparisons really matter here. In a way, Burke is responding to that first round of ads from the Walker Group, the Republican Governors Association, arguing that Wisconsin lost jobs while she was Secretary of Commerce in the Doyle administration. Her ad comes back and says, actually, when I was Secretary of Commerce, unemployment was lower than it is today under Scott Walker. The Walker campaign has now come back and said, actually, unemployment was relatively high when Walker took over as governor, but it has come down while he has been in office. So I think all of them are probably technically correct, but there's just a sleight of hand going on to try to emphasize comparisons in a way that are most favorable to their side.
Are they, in a way, comparing apples and oranges, slightly different time frames?
They are. Burke is saying, look at the era in which I was in the administration and compare that to today, and things were worse off. The Walker campaign on the other side is saying, compare the first day I took office, which is what I inherited, to where we are today. Things are better. And I think voters are just going to have to decide for themselves which of those comparisons seems fairest.
So in terms of ads that tend to get lighter and then you see more and more of them as this election season goes along, how effective are they in swaying the public?
Well, it depends which side you're on. So I think for someone like Scott Walker, the electorate has such strong feelings about him at this point. They know him. Everyone has an opinion. More ads that he runs about himself to kind of introduce himself to the electorate are probably not going to have much effect. He's going to be more effective in trying to nail down Burke as an undesirable replacement. Burke, on the other hand, is really unknown to most voters and I think has a long way to go to make a favorable impression. And so some introductory biographical ads to tout positive things about her record could really be useful. The trouble is she has this candidate on the other side who's trying to interrupt that process. And so it's going to be a tough road for her.
Now, in the recall election, there were a lot of people who credited the pro-Walker ads, and there were a lot of them, with swaying some of the way public sentiment went and ultimately the recall election. Do you think that ads like that will be used in a similar way this time around?
I don't know. You know, there's a very small segment of the electorate who is undecided about whether they like Scott Walker and would like to see him stay in office or see him removed. So really, I still think much of this is about how his opponent is defined. If she comes across as viable, credible, active, able to do things, fix things that we think are wrong today, she will have a shot. If the Walker campaign is able to undermine her message or she stumbles along the way and isn't able to do that, then I think Walker, because of the money he has, the resources and the experience he has in running two campaigns here statewide, will probably end up being victorious.
Is there such a thing as ad fatigue? I know by the end of an election campaign, pretty much everyone will say, yes, you know, we're tired of all the ads. But is it cumulative? Do we start out tired of them?
Oh, I don't think anybody likes even that first negative ad they see. it's a little bit like winter. Maybe there's a novelty of that first snowflake in November. by now, we're ready to be done with it. It doesn't take much of the stuff to make you tired. And, you know, campaign ads, people do complain about them. They turn the channel or mute the television when they're on, but they're run for a reason, and it's that they're at least somewhat effective. They're effective at getting out your voters if you're running ads for yourself. They're effective sometimes at demobilizing your opponents. If you can raise questions about the other party's nominee, you can try to just sort of discourage the enthusiasm of their supporters, and then hopefully you can actually sway some people to your side and bring them over from supporting your opponent to supporting you.
Now, the ads that we just heard, both from Governor Walker and from Mary Burke, they both had a similarity, and it was sort of your standard, it seemed to me, campaign ad with the narration, a voice with gravitas, and some facts thrown at you. There was nothing that was really unusual about them. Is that typical of the kind of ad that's most effective?
The short answer is I don't know. You know, those ads are a little bit of sugar, a little bit of spice. So you offer something good about yourself. There's a positive image of the candidate. There's nice music and some mention of their accomplishments in office or in the private sector. And then you offer a contrast, and the screen turns dark. The music's more ominous, and present some statistics or something negative about your opponent, and then maybe in the end come back to yourself. So you're trying to offer different things, maybe to different voters, a positive message about who you are and something to worry about in the opponent.
In terms of the tone, Scott Walker's ad seemed a little bit more chatty, a little more personal. Is that something that you think appeals to people?
Yeah, you know, every voter has different things that they care about. Walker has strong supporters and strong opponents who may not be moved regardless of new information that comes out. But there is a segment there that I think thinks about him as a person, whether he's likable, approachable, reasonable, you know, has good judgment, all the things you'd look for in someone in public office. And that can be conveyed, accurately or not, in campaign advertisements. So you see, even in the Burke ad, there's an image of her sort of walking through what looks like a factory in an office of some kind, and, you know, mention of her working with Trek Bicycle. So there's a message about who she is as a person that's trying to be conveyed there, just as it is in the Walker ad.
Well, as you mentioned, the Marquette poll shows that Mary Burke is lacking in statewide recognition. Are the ads enough to get her back in the game, or is it going to take something more than that?
It's going to take everything she's got. It's not an impossible task, but it's uphill. I think about a comparison we might make between her campaign and that of Ron Johnson when he first ran for U.S. Senate in 2010. At this time in the year, he was an unknown quantity. I'm not sure that he was a candidate at this point. But by May, he was suddenly a known figure. He had wrapped up the Republican nomination, and he ended up defeating a Democratic incumbent in Russ Feingold. So it's possible, if you've got the resources and a good team and a good set of advertisements, the right strategy, to be successful. You've just got to have a lot of tailwinds and not make any mistakes.
Well, Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Good talking with you.
That was Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're getting a little bit more sunshine every day, but the temperatures are still pretty cold here in Wisconsin, and none of that local produce is in season quite yet.
But we still have good old root vegetables to keep us company. So on this Food Friday, we decided to talk about some different ways to prepare them other than the classic oven roast.
Lori Skelton is with us. She's one of WPR's in-house foodies. Lori, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Let's lay our ingredients on the table first. What root vegetables are we going to talk about today?
Well, some of the recipes that we're talking about can cover just about any. You know, start with potatoes or sweet potatoes. Move on to things that aren't quite so well liked. Turnips, rutabaga, celery root, and then weird things like sunchokes. It's basically anything that's under the ground, has a lot of great nutritional value, but especially at this time of the year, a lot of us are just tired of boil it and drown it in butter, or I'd like something other than the great, toss it with olive oil and throw it in a hot oven and roast it.
That's my standby, yeah.
Which is perfectly wonderful, because what oven roasting, and in some cases what grilling can do in the summer, is it takes that starch that's in a root vegetable and it turns it into sugar. It makes it sweet. It makes it mellow. So many people I talk to about root vegetables always bring this up, and they talk about how grounding it is, which is certainly wonderful in the midst of winter. But as much as I love winter, it's gone on a little too long. Normally at this time of the year, I'd already be out in my garden looking for the first sorrel, the first greens of spring.
And bring your snow shovel.
And I am so ready for something green and bright and lighter. So that was the inspiration behind lighter ways to work with a root vegetable.
Well, one of your starting points, when I think of turnips and parsnips, well, rutabagas I'm looking for in my pasties. But what I do with a lot of these other things is maybe throw them in a stew or a soup, and a soup was one of your starting points, right? A parsnip soup.
Which I'm sorry to say I was unable to recreate. This was something that a friend of mine came up with on his own, and I tried to do it in a day. And this is something you have to cook your vegetables low and slow. You start off by making a basic vegetable broth, then you create a separate parsnip broth, and then once you've got your two broths talking together so that it tastes rich but the texture is light, then you glaze parsnips and add that to the soup. It's something I will definitely keep trying, but it's not something you can put together, I found out, in under 24 hours. You really need a couple of days and a couple of steps to get the taste just right.
Well, one soup you did do and brought in and I tasted, it was quite good, a golden beet borscht. And that had a really summery feel. It didn't feel like a heavy, dense winter root vegetable kind of thing.
Well, you start off with golden beets. I mean, there's your bright color right there. I ended up adapting a recipe from the good old Moosewood Cookbook from the 1970s, taking golden beets, and instead of using some of the heavier things that can be used in a borscht, like cabbage and potatoes and heavier sour cream, this had cucumber and fresh dill and scallions and buttermilk instead of the sour cream. So it was lighter. I left it chunky, and you could go ahead and puree this in a blender if you wanted a smoother, more elegant presentation. But somebody actually said it looked like chunky sunshine, and it really did feel like spring today.
Yeah, I think of borscht as get you through the Eastern European winter, and this felt more like, hey, it's Eastern European spring.
I actually had somebody tell me, I've eaten a lot of borscht in my life, and I've never been fond of it, but this is pretty good. This lighter version is quite nice.
And then turning away from soups, another way to go is pickling things. You brought in a couple options. How much does it take to pickle our root vegetables?
I know you guys have talked about pickling on this show before. Mm-hmm. The one pickle I brought in, you can have in under 8 hours. Quick carrot pickle. So easy. You throw a little bit of red wine or cider vinegar in a pot, heat it up with sugar, salt, and dill seed. Throw your carrots in and just let it sit. And within hours, you've got this lovely, quick little pickle. I tried something that I honestly wasn't sure I'd like, and that was rutabaga pickles, which required a little bit of extra brining time. The pickling brine for that had cider vinegar, honey, lemon juice, cumin, mustard, coriander, cayenne, and smoked paprika. And they recommend you let that sit in the refrigerator for about a week. I gave it 5 days, and it was pretty darn tasty. This was a popular thing that was in the break room today. A lot of people gave it a thumbs
up. A lot of people like the rutabaga. I'll say I like the carrots a lot. And for the rutabaga, Lori, I've loved everything else you've made. The rutabaga, maybe a little vinegary for me. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, pickled things are vinegary by their nature. I do know
exactly.
That.
Exactly. So let me ask you, the carrots were a little crisper. The rutabaga had a little bit of give to it. What was the texture that you preferred?
I did prefer the crisper texture.
Okay.
I guess I'm a crisp pickle guy.
Okay. And,
but I didn't know it.
And here again, so many things that we're talking about, mix and match. Find the vegetable that works for you.
So that pickled rutabaga thing, could you try it? I mean, could you just do it exactly the way you did it, but sub in turnips or parsnips?
Turnips or parsnips might work with this particular pickle because of the heat, the cayenne, the smoked paprika. I don't know if I'd want to go that spicy with a carrot.
Okay.
But again, it'd be something fun to try.
You know, parsnips I like a lot. I forget about them. I kind of use them with carrots or in substitution for carrots. Any parsnip recommendations for me?
Well, one lovely thing to do with any root vegetable, and parsnips would certainly work well with this, we're missing green at this time of the year.
Oh, yeah.
And I made a simple parsley sauce where you pound a little parsley in with garlic and sea salt and peppercorns in your mortar, and then you add a little more fresh chopped parsley and scallions and lemon peel and olive oil. You can serve that on top of any root vegetable. You can try it raw. You can boil them, serve them room temperature. You can serve them warm. Again, I was really surprised. I brought in turnips and sunchokes to pair with that parsley sauce. That was the first thing to go.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I really like the parsley sauce. And you could do that. And that's something that's super flexible, like you said.
Yeah. The other thing, of course, that we've kind of shied away from because it's not necessarily light, but it's still comforting. If you're not comfortable working with certain root vegetables, start off by boiling them and then mashing them in with your mashed potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
And parsnips is a great way to, you know, you lighten the mashed potatoes with parsnips. You make them sweeter. You may not need as much butter. And so that's another good way to get more root vegetables into your life. Just slowly introduce them into your mashed potatoes and see where they go.
And you mentioned celery root. Celeriac, is that the same
celeriac.
Thing?
Celeriac. And that's a great one to mash with potatoes.
Okay.
It's also a good one to, if you're getting adventurous, to do in a curry. And if you're going to curry a root vegetable, one other nice thing to do, especially at this time of year, if you need a little green, add some fennel bulb to it. That'll brighten it up. It's just moist enough, it's just sweet enough, and just green enough to give it a twist.
All right. Well, a lot of great ideas. More generally, do we not give our root vegetables enough love? They're not the glamour, you know, the pinups of the vegetable world for us, are they?
No, they're not. They do not have the hipster chic of kale chips. They are what get us through the winter, and they are comforting. They are a staple. And if you give them just a little bit more attention, I think they can surprise you.
All right. Well, a lot of good surprises. And by the way, out there, if you want to try something here with your root vegetables, there's a borscht recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Lori provided us with that. I think the borscht was my biggest hit of all the things you made today, Lori. That was my favorite. Any permutations that we might try on that, apart from what's in the recipe itself?
Well, if you are a fan of traditional borscht with red beets, go ahead and use them. Go ahead and, if you're going to do that, add some things that are a little more tart. You can chop up pickles and add to that. That's going to lighten, again, the texture, give it a little bit of a different feel to it. Other traditional accompaniments with borscht are those potatoes and hard-boiled eggs.
Oh, yeah, that would be perfect.
So if you wanted to make your borscht a little bit more of a meal, go ahead and add some protein to it.
I might try doing it that way. Lori, thank you so much for joining us again.
Absolutely.
That was our own Lori Skelton, a WPR in-house foodie.